This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Columbus Day in Boston, but Brookline, Cambridge, and Somerville are celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day. Now, Indigenous and Italian Americans continue to stand on opposite sides of the Columbus Day question. Indigenous American activists note Columbus is accused of enabling slavery in the Caribbean, of brutal treatment towards Indigenous Americans, and of a legacy connected with the later genocide of Indigenous American peoples. Italian-American activists see Columbus as the first immigrant and a symbol of Italian contributions to the American story. But the narrative's changing. With increasing public support for renaming this holiday to Indigenous Peoples Day and a growing number of Italian-Americans rejecting Columbus as the appropriate symbol for their immigrant contributions to the nation. So let's talk about that. We turn first to Danielle Battisti. She is an associate professor at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Her book is Whom We Shall Welcome, Italian Americans and Immigration Reform. Danielle, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start with a piece that you put in the Washington Post today called Columbus Day Had Value for Italian Americans, but it's time to rethink it. How did you get to that place, briefly, that it's time to move beyond Christopher Columbus for Italian Americans?
Well, the piece really looks at the history of how Italian Americans have used the day to craft meaning around their group's public identity. Historically, Italian Americans have used public symbols like monuments, like Columbus Day and other celebrations, to reach a broader audience in the United States about their group's position in the nation. And so I write about these topics largely in my book, which is about immigration reform. And in that book, Columbus Day often took center stage. It was a day every single year where Italian Americans could remind the nation of number one, their group's contributions to the nation, and also past instances of discrimination, and in the 1950s and 60s, current levels of discrimination. And so they sort of use that day to speak to broader audiences.
So I want to note, I'm Italian-American. My grandfather came from Oronzo, Italy, at the beginning of last century. And I wonder if you can tell us, walk briefly through what the experience of Italian Americans to the United States in the 19th century was and how that led to the first observance of Columbus Day.
Like so many other sort of Southern and Eastern European immigrants, Asian immigrants, and others who were coming to the United States at the turn of the century, these were really global labor migrants who were pushed and pulled by the flows of industrial capitalism, whose families made collective decisions to advance the family household economy, and chose migration as one of many strategies to get ahead. There were very few laws regulating both emigration and immigration policies in the late 19th century. Increasingly, there were more as the 20th century went onward. And these groups generally joined in a number of working class Americans who were finding positions in industrial America, agricultural America. Italian Americans are sort of part of that labor migration, and the roots of Columbus Day do sort of appear in the same time period. Now, there are multifaceted roots of this holiday. Columbus really begins to be celebrated in the mid-19th century when a nation, a very new nation, largely composed of immigrants since Native Americans had been pushed to the margins at best or written out of history, are looking for some shared symbols or shared history to build upon. Washington Irving popularizes Columbus in a wildly inaccurate book about what he did, and Americans sort of grasp on to that narrative and create this image of Columbus for the nation. The imagery of Columbia becomes quite popular. We see the high point of this national veneration of Columbus around the Columbian Exposition in Chicago around 1892-1893. It's at that very same moment that many Italian immigrants are facing a great deal of discrimination in the United States. In New Orleans, there's the notorious lynching of 11 Sicilians, and that's a story bound up in racial dynamics. And it's a period in which many Italian immigrants are being vilified as criminals, as other problematic sorts of undesirable immigrants in the nation. And so many Italian Americans, Italian immigrants, start to grasp on to Columbus as a different face of who they are. And they and others start to associate Columbus Day with Italian immigrants. And so this starts to happen at state and local levels. Columbus Day doesn't become a national holiday until the 1970s.
So, you know, one of the things that's interesting about that was that over time, associating heritage with Columbus was a way for Italian Americans to actually fully claim whiteness. And at the same time, you note that that was not a rejection of the supremacy of whiteness. Italian Americans, in doing so, didn't challenge the notion that discrimination against immigrants or other groups in the U.S. was inherently flawed. It was, I think the phrase that I read was, it was a way to flip to the other side of the ledger. That is a really complicated piece of history.
Yes, I write about this in my book, Whom We Shall Welcome. So in that book, I study Italian-American campaigns to reform America's discriminatory immigration system in the 1950s and 60s. And this was a period when Italian immigrants were considered undesirable immigrants and still limited to about 5,000 Italian non-quota immigrants coming into the nation each year. And so I look at the ways in which Italian-Americans try to combat that discrimination. And there are progressive elements, liberal elements to their campaign, but there are also conservative elements as well. And what I write about in my book is that there are many ways in which, in the 1950s and 60s, Italian Americans claim whiteness, and they essentially say, if we are just as white as German Americans, Irish Americans, etc., why can they immigrate to the United States in large numbers and yet we can't? And so Columbus Day, or painting Columbus in certain ways that I speak about in that Washington Post piece and I write about more extensively, is one way that they try to claim respectability and entrance into the American mainstream. And ultimately, we see that there are many conservative elements of their campaigns, and Italian Americans, I think, unfortunately, are less vocal in saying immigration restriction based on racism is wrong. Rather, they focus on the fact that they are, in fact, good immigrants, white immigrants, and therefore they should be rewarded as well. And I don't think that this is purposeful. I think that we see many groups relying on this narrative because it practically results in political gains. Even today, people who defend Dreamers tend to fall into this category. Rather than saying, you know, it's wrong to discriminate against someone who came to this country without choice at 2 years old, we tend to hear that Dreamers can stay or should stay because they've graduated from high school, gone to college, served in the military, contribute to the economy. So it's a very complicated story.
So we've got a couple minutes left, Danielle, and there is a lot there. In fact, some of it reminds me of a couple of the chapters from the book The Warmth of Other Suns from Isabel Wilkerson, where she talks about the great migration from south to north of Black Americans and the struggle with other immigrant populations in the 20th century for status and standing. Where I want to pivot now is we are now in a moment where there are two things happening. Increasingly, Indigenous peoples and other Americans are agitating and advocating to rename Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, and more Italian Americans are recognizing, or what's the word I'm looking for, are considering advocating for a different approach to celebrating the American contribution that Italian Americans have made. Where could that lead us? What is, as a historian and someone who writes and thinks about this, what is a healthy outcome for the United States?
Well, historians have the privilege of talking about the past, so I'll try to stay there. I do think that this is the right moment to be having this conversation, as we're having so many conversations about monuments and other public symbols like holidays. You know, these conversations are aren't about preserving history. They're about choices about who we choose to commemorate, celebrate, value, what we choose to employ as identity markers for the nation. So I think it's a great start that we are having these long overdue conversations. If you look to some other nations that have dealt with questions of problematic history, you see conversations about repositioning monuments, contextualizing them with more history, or even removing and relocating monuments to museums. This has been a solution that's been quite popular in Germany so that one can sort of get the proper context around some of these monuments that once stood in the past and perhaps may not in the future.
Well, that is Danielle Battisti, an associate professor at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and author of the book, Whom We Shall Welcome, Italian Americans and Immigration Reform. She also has a piece in the Washington Post today on Columbus Day had value for Italian Americans, but that's time to rethink it. Thanks so much for being with us on Radio Boston, Danielle.
Thank you.
So let's turn now to someone who supports a nationwide change from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. Joining us now is Paula Peters, or Sonk Wabin. She's a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and an independent scholar of Wampanoag history. Welcome, Paula.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I thought I'd start by asking you, how are you observing today? How are you choosing to spend your time?
You know, I am spending my time by reflecting on the sacrifices that our ancestors have made, but also on the continued necessity for us to advocate for ourselves as we are still here. And by keeping alive our culture and, you know, bringing our history into balance with what we see today from a historical perspective.
Paula, there were marchers in Boston on Saturday demanding that the city rename Columbus Day, and a lot of surrounding communities have. They've renamed the day to honor Indigenous people, Cambridge, Somerville, Newton's voting on it next week. Why is that so important both locally and nationally? What is at stake?
Well, there is a great deal at stake. And, you know, ironically, as American natives, we can sympathize with the Italian people who want to celebrate their history and their heritage. But for Native people, we have been marginalized historically for hundreds of years. This year, marking the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower, it's something that is being commemorated, and it's a time when we are stepping up to tell that story with the balance of the Wampanoag perspective. And that's critically important. It's critically important also to look at what not only colonization, but prior to colonization, there were so many atrocities committed upon Indigenous people of North and South America that began with Christopher Columbus. He was a brutal leader that came from Italy and just destroyed the Arawak people. My children, they're grown now. I have three grown children. They did not attend school prior to Columbus Day without me giving them a copy of Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, because even then, I knew how important it was for that story to be told in balance. And it's not something that is made up or exaggerated. It's in his own word that he writes about how he treated these people and how he enslaved
in Columbus's own words, you're saying, just to clarify?
Yeah, yes, in Columbus's own words. And I just wanted to read a little piece of that. That after he took and enslaved his first 500 people to be Arawak, to be taken away as slaves, and 200 of them died in the journey over, he said, "Let us, in the name of the Holy Trinity, go on sending all the slaves that can be sold." So there was just absolutely no humanity from this man. And he was just brutal to the people of what is today known as Haiti.
So I want to ask you then, at the beginning of that answer, you talked about how Indigenous Americans can understand or sympathize with Italian Americans wanting a place and a way to celebrate their heritage and history and contribution to the United States today. And then you just laid out some stark language, and I think you were pulling those words from Columbus, from Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So that then begs the question, is it possible to celebrate both? Is it possible for Italian Americans to celebrate Columbus and Indigenous Americans to demand recognition for the truth of the history of America and Indigenous peoples? Or is the impact from Columbus too great on Indigenous Americans to hold that tension?
You know, in terms of the impact of Columbus, you've inspired me to just look at one other piece where Lacasis writes about, and this is in Howard Zinn's book, there were 60,000 people living on this island, including the Indians, so that from 1494 to 1508, over 3 million people had perished. That was under the rule of Christopher Columbus. How do you wipe out 3 million people? I think that there are so many other contributions that Italians have, from philosophy to theology, food, art. There was Hortensia, who advocated for women's rights as far back as 42 BC. There's Galileo, who was perhaps the greatest scholar of physics and astronomy. There's Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci. There are so many people in history that we can celebrate as Italian people. Why they would choose to cling to Christopher Columbus, who was just such a horrific person, it boggles my mind.
So Paula, you also talked about the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower landing on the shores of Patuxent, now Plymouth, 1620. And I want to talk about a couple of exhibits that you've participated in. The Peabody Museum of Archaeology and Ethnology at Harvard is marking that anniversary with an online exhibit called Listening to Wampanoag Voices Beyond 1620. And also the traveling exhibition, Our Story, 400 Years of Wampanoag History. You participated in both of those exhibits. You know, this emphasis on 1620 really strikes me because of its proximity to the date 1619, which, as you may know, was the title of a New York Times project that seeks to re-anchor our narrative American history to the advent of slavery. I think about Columbus Day and Thanksgiving. Are you seeking a re-anchoring of our narrative American history to this 1620 date and the time after that, especially in New England, where Thanksgiving is such an important holiday for us?
Yes, well, certainly, because there are so many critical backstories to 1620, and that's been a very comfortable place for the casual consumer of history to land in 1620. It's etched on the Plymouth Rock. It's where we know Mayflower landed, and this happy story of friendly Indians and desperate pilgrims unite and have this wonderful harvest, and then they give birth to the Thanksgiving holiday. And there's so much myth around that. But these histories that are not told really inform us in so many ways. And I, you know, kudos to the Peabody for allowing us to give voice to our story through these objects. And it also acknowledges that, you know, that we are still here, that Wampanoag people are able to tell their own story. It's very, very critically important.
And that's Paula Peters, or Sonk Wabin. She's a member of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe and an independent scholar of Wampanoag history. She's a part of Listening to Wampanoag Voices Beyond 1620, a virtual exhibit at Harvard's Peabody Museum. And you can find a link at our website, radioboston.org. Paula, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, we have talked on the air before about the lessons that we can learn by paying attention to the ongoing battle between professional sports and the coronavirus. While the New England Patriots, who were supposed to play today after rescheduling from Sunday, have had to postpone their game again due to new infections. So let's check the score between the virus and Boston's pro sports teams with Radio Boston's Chris Siderek. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
Listeners, we want to hear from you. Call in to Chris and me. What do you make of the current mess that the NFL is in, that the Patriots are in right now? How do you think we've handled bringing back sports overall? Any winners? Any great lessons? Any cautionary lessons from how we're seeing professional sports do this? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris, okay, I think the thing to do here is to have you just start by walking us through what's happened with the Pats and the coronavirus over the last 10 days, because it has been kind of crazy.
Yeah, there's been more plot twists than the first three seasons of Game of Thrones, I think. So this is the second outbreak that the league is dealing with. The Tennessee Titans had their outbreak start on September 24th, and that's basically still ongoing. So it gives you an idea of how this thing can go if it's not handled well. So if we go back to a week ago Saturday, we got the news Saturday morning that Cam Newton, Patriots quarterback, had tested positive on Friday. Now, the Pats had a game scheduled for the following day, Sunday, against the Chiefs. It's worth noting that's a huge game for the NFL. Two marquee franchises, brings a big audience. So there's a lot of money on the line there. The league really wants that game to happen. So that game gets moved from Sunday to Monday, contingent, obviously, on no new test results. The Patriots are taking a few extra precautions. They actually took two planes to that game, you might remember, about 20 players and staff that had close contact with Newton on one plane, and then a plane of those who had not had close contact with him. But those guys are all in the same locker room together, on the sidelines together, on the field together. So there's obviously some crossover there. So then on Tuesday last week, Patriots cornerback Stephon Gilmore tests positive. We get that news on Wednesday. The Patriots close down their facility. On Thursday, they have no new positives. So the NFL says the game can still go on. They move the game against the Broncos from Sunday to Monday today. The Patriots decide to keep their facilities closed until Saturday, and I want to point out that that's a Bill Belichick decision, so put a pin in that. We'll come back to that. Yesterday morning, wake up, there's another positive test. That brings the team's total to four, and the NFL decides to move that game. The team will be closed down until Wednesday when they can begin practicing for next Sunday.
Well, I just feel like, Chris, this is a really good moment to note, and we've heard this on the Dr. Collins segments on Radio Boston so often. There's a difference between the test turnaround time of 24 hours and how long somebody can be symptomatic and infectious, right? Can spread the coronavirus. So the compressed time frame of the last 10 days that you told us, there were like three different games that should have been played during that time, which is just kind of mind-boggling. Now, when the season started, you and I talked about the fact that NFL has had more time than any other of the major pro sports teams to get ready for this, but it doesn't seem like they've played it out well. And are they able to adjust now that we're starting to see these rates spread?
I mean, there's a lot there to unpack. So I want to first comment, you're absolutely right about the time of transmission. The CDC says it can take up to 14 days for the virus to show up, and that you can still be contagious for 72 hours without showing any symptoms, or you may never show symptoms at all. So as you mentioned, the slow test results, having a game a couple of days after you know that the virus is on your team is questionable at best, I'd say. And the lack of planning you're talking about is hugely frustrating. The NFL had 5 months to figure out something. And they basically decided we're going to go ahead with the same number of games, the same schedule, the same bye weeks as we would in a normal year. For an example of how complicated this could get moving forward, I want to read you something here, Tiziana. Buckle up, because these are all the games that had to move just to accommodate the Broncos-Patriots game moving from today until next Sunday. So you also had the Chiefs-Bills game from Thursday move to next Monday. You've got Jets-Dolphins from week 10 goes to week 6. Jets-Chargers goes from week 6 to week 11. Jaguars-Chargers goes from week 8 to week 7. Chargers-Broncos from week 11 to week 8. Chargers-Dolphins from week 7 to week 10. Dolphins-Broncos from week 6 to week 11. And I'm just weak, because that is a lot to handle. And it just shows you how many moving pieces there are.
Well, and it also seems untenable. Chris, let me just put the number out. Are you as overwhelmed as I am, listeners, by hearing that list? I mean, I don't even know how you shift that many games around. You think about the logistics of it, and I'm sure Chris will bring us back to the money of it as well. How are you responding to the NFL and the moment it finds itself in, and the moment the Patriots find themselves in this pandemic? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, I mean, that's nuts, Chris. What are the players saying?
Yeah, it is nuts, and it shows you they don't have the flexibility that, say, baseball did, and they obviously are not doing the bubble that hockey or basketball did. So the players are having mixed reactions. You know, some have expressed concerns about not being able to have their same routines. Football is really built on Wednesdays we practice X, Thursdays we practice Y, and kind of staying with that routine throughout the year. So that's gone pretty much. Bye weeks are a huge deal for football. Having a week off to get some guys back from injury, to rest, to maybe change some of your strategies, formations, things like that. I actually think, and actually that's, you're hearing the Broncos complain about that because they practiced all week last week getting ready for the Patriots game. And now they're told, oh, surprise, that was your week off. Hope you enjoyed all those practices you wouldn't have had otherwise.
Without the rest, right.
Yeah, exactly. They're really upset about that. And I think rightfully so. You mentioned player reaction here. The Patriots have had, I think, some interesting voices step forward. Jason McCourty, the cornerback for the Pats, was on phone calls with the league and the player association this week. And I want to play a little bit of what he said about that experience this Saturday.
So for them, it's not about what's in our best interest or our health and safety. It's about, you know, what can we make protocol wise that sounds good, looks good, and how can we go out there and play games? So I think what I kind of learned personally throughout this situation is going to be up to us as the individuals in this building to just really take care of one another.
So, you know, on the one hand, that's great. The team's looking out for each other and individual accountability and all that. But that's a lot to put on a team and the players. And also that idea that your own players association doesn't care about you. He said at one point during that commentary, they don't care. And so you started hearing these rumblings over the weekend that the Patriots, even if the league was saying the game was still on, they were thinking about what it would mean if they decided not to play. And that obviously would have huge ramifications for the NFL.
So I'm cueing in on that being one of the McCourty brothers who have so often provided leadership, you know, on the Patriots. You're talking about the fact that the league is leaving it up to the teams. Let's size up the teams. Let's size up the Pats and other teams. You know, if they're leaving it up to the teams and we're seeing spread like this, it sounds like that is not working.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the league is in real trouble here if they don't find a way to become more flexible and figure out a workable solution, because crossing your fingers and hoping that the virus is not going to continue to spread around the league, I think is being pretty naive. You look at the Tennessee Titans, in the middle of their outbreak, they're now being investigated for players holding workouts that were not authorized by the league, that they were supposed to be shut down. And there they are out on the field working out together. So clearly not doing what they should to slow the outbreak. I want to go back to the Bill Belichick decision not to hold practice at the end of last week, because Jason McCourty hit on that on Saturday as well and basically said something I think is pretty relatable, that Coach Belichick and the rest of the team really are just trying to figure this thing out just like the rest of us.
The coronavirus has stopped us all, and we've all had to figure it out. And that's what we're doing here. No different than my kids figuring out how they're going to go to school this year, or anybody else throughout our country. And I think he felt like just from different doctors and medical experts who have been studying and getting to know this virus, that it was in our best interest not to be around each other because there was still a lot of uncertainty and a lot of unknowns.
I don't know about you, Tiziana, but that idea of uncertainty and unknowns feels pretty relevant in our lives right now. And I think it leaves so much up to the organization. And it's important to remember, you're not just talking about the players. You're talking about their families and friends, folks that they might potentially bring the virus to outside of that. And I want to go back to Bill Belichick's approach, because listen to how he described the way he's thinking about this on Saturday.
Literally taking this... I wouldn't even say day by day. It's more hour by hour. So we'll continue to move forward, but at the same time, know that we have to be ready to change, adjust, and adapt as the situation calls for.
Okay, so Chris, I'm going to let my emotions out here a little bit, because I hear this day by day, hour by hour, and I go back to the fact that you said just a couple of minutes ago the NFL had 5 months to prepare for and plan for running a season during a pandemic. And even more so, they had an example in the NBA of a successful way to do that. So let's do a little compare and contrast here. Talk about the outcomes that didn't happen in the NBA, the choices that they made, because this is our moment where we are learning from the experience of pro sports in the coronavirus era.
Yeah, I think it's a great comparison, because basically everything the NFL is doing wrong, the NBA did right, and they came before them. So how have they not taken that lesson and run with it? There were things the NFL could have done. They could have added extra bye weeks. They could have shortened the season to make room for that. They could add a week to the end of the year. There are lots of ways to give themselves more flexibility, but they really just kind of charged ahead business as usual. And I think, unfortunately, that's kind of indicative of this league. The NFL, you know, likes to talk about the shield, you know, the NFL logo in the shape of a shield. When they discipline players, they do it because they're protecting the shield. It's almost like they thought this shield was a real shield that was going to protect them from a virus that's running rampant. You look at the NBA, they just finished 172 games over 3 months, zero positive tests. That is staggering, I think, both in terms of a sports accomplishment, but also in terms of a public health accomplishment. They had the bubble. We've talked about that in the past, but it's not an airtight bubble. There were, you know,
well, and remind Chris, take a second here. Yeah, remind people what the bubble means. Remember, you know, not a lot of our listeners may know the details of how the bubble worked in the NBA. Just briefly, when we say bubble, what do we mean?
Yeah, so basically players and coaches and certain media members basically went to this hotel complex at part of Disney World in Florida. And they were forced to quarantine before they got there. Then they get there, they take a test, and they weren't really allowed to move around the area until they show that their test results are negative. And then they basically had free reign of certain parts of the hotel resort, but they couldn't leave. That was kind of the deal. You're here for the 3 month run, and everybody can be a little looser in terms of restrictions because they're in the bubble. They're not leaving. They're not being exposed to anyone else who might be carrying the virus. There were also folks who came into that bubble. Like I said, hotel staff, folks like that, that would have to follow very strict protocol, testing, quarantining, distancing, masks. And I think that is really one of the biggest lessons out of this, is that stuff works. That really, if you follow the recommendations and you take those steps to protect the situation, that you really can slow the spread. Zero cases over 3 months. It's crazy.
Yeah, so here's the other lesson I find myself thinking that we're taking out of this, and this feels important because, as we know, in this moment, we are also experiencing a national reckoning on race, a massive national reckoning on race and on a history of systemic racism and anti-blackness in America. And here we have a league, the NBA, with players who are speaking out, feeling empowered, talking about Black Lives Matter, putting messages on their jerseys, really empowered as players to call the shots. And then you have the NFL with its history of suppressing messaging on race, on Black Lives Matter, on the history of systemic racism, and a relationship where it sounds like the players feel the owners are being very cavalier with their lives and health. And I think one can't help but compare and contrast those two things, Chris.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Tiziana. And think back, remember, the Milwaukee Bucks, basically, whether you want to call it a strike or a boycott, they declined to participate in a playoff game because they were trying to send a message about the exact issues you're talking about there. And the league reached out to the players, talked it over with them, figured out ways that they could kind of bring everybody to the table. Compare that to the NFL, who basically ran Colin Kaepernick out of the league for years for kneeling quietly during the national anthem. You're talking about two very different approaches. And I think that ownership dynamic is really important. The NBA is kind of long been considered the league where player empowerment is at its greatest. And there's even been some debate in recent years about whether or not there's too much player empowerment in terms of determining where they want to play and who they want to play with. I think you really saw the strengths of allowing the players to have that kind of sway. Compare that to the NFL, where there are no guaranteed contracts. Players are basically at-will employees and those deals can be ripped up as soon as they go down and suffer a career-ending injury. So you're talking about the most dangerous sport does the least to protect its players. And that's been a theme that's long been the case with the NFL. And I think you're really seeing that being driven home in the pandemic.
So, okay, we have had 6 months now to watch baseball, basketball, hockey, and football. And I do want to acknowledge for our listeners, the world is full of many more sports and women playing them as well as men. But right now we're focusing on the lessons of these big American professional sports trying to navigate the pandemic era. What are the lessons that are emerging here, Chris?
I mean, I think the biggest one is being smart works, right? Sitting down and thinking about things and planning it out. It's what both the NHL and the NBA did when they came up with their plans. And it worked. You saw them complete their seasons. And I think they were faced with a much more challenging task than the NFL was. The NFL had kind of the perfect calendar setup to basically put something into place to deal with this. They had just finished the Super Bowl about a month before this pandemic really caught on here, and they could have taken that time to sit down and thoughtfully come up with a plan. They didn't. They just kind of charged ahead and hoped that things would be okay without any sort of big picture vision. And I think that's what's most frustrating coming out of this situation. We'll see if they can adapt and make it through. They're going to have to be more flexible than they've been up to this point. And there's going to be a point where the calendar is not going to cooperate with them. So I think that's on the logistical side. The takeaway for me, to be honest, I think sports are good for the soul. And I think having them back has been just an absolute thrill. Being able to, it's a communal experience. You can watch and enjoy with each other, even if we're together alone or however you want to put it. Sports bring us together. The stories bring us together. And I think it's been a beautiful thing.
Well, I love loving sports with you. That's Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, thanks for being on today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, if you grew up in the 80s, you might remember this commercial.
I'll be waiting like a cat with my infinity the cut. It's great to be a king.
Stride Right Zips Big D sneakers help you move fast and turn quickly, and they look terrific.
It's great to be a king.
Oh, that brings me back. But Stride White, it was about more than shoes. In 1971, it became the first U.S. employer to offer a company-run daycare center. And that was at Stride White's then headquarters in Roxbury. Arnold Hyatt ran the company then, and almost 20 years later, in 1990, he broke new ground again, establishing the first intergenerational daycare center in the country to help employees who were caring for older relatives in addition to those who had childcare needs. Hyatt ran Stride Right for 25 years, and he was known for believing that corporations should treat employees well and contribute to the surrounding community. Here he is talking about that at a news conference put on by the organization Businesses for Social Responsibility in 1992.
If you think about what works in our business, the shoe business or in any business, the ice cream business, you think that you succeed only if you can identify the needs or the desires of your consumers. And that same principle applies to the needs of your employees and the needs of your community.
Now, Hyatt's reform instincts were less successful in politics. A longtime activist, he decried campaign finance practices, but also proved a top Democratic fundraiser and donor. Now 92 years old, we recently spoke with Arnold Hyatt about his lifetime of experience in business and politics, what he learned along the way, and why he's concerned that business schools are failing to teach the importance of the public trust today. I started by asking him, as he looks back on his life, how he defines himself, whether he thinks of himself as a businessman, philanthropist, or political activist first.
Unfortunately, money plays too much of a part in the political process. Unless I succeeded at business, I couldn't have had the subsequent callings. I couldn't have been involved to the extent that I was in politics, for example. So I had to sort of build a financial platform to be active in the political arena.
So let's stay with that financial platform that you built first. You spent almost your entire professional life running companies. I wonder, did you always know you wanted to be in business? And did you imagine yourself in leadership roles?
No. I majored in history in college. And at the time, I thought I would end up teaching. But then something got in the way. I met a young woman from Vassar. We became engaged, and I knew that I'd had to support a family, and that influenced my change of plans. I never really intended to go into business. I was somewhat insufferable in my college days and looked down upon business as something having to do with just making money, and that didn't seem like a calling that I like to be involved in. I realized that was a rather immature assessment of an activity I didn't know much about.
I think that is so interesting, given that you really were a pioneer in terms of taking care of your employees and things that we would now call corporate social responsibility. So, for example, you launched a daycare center at Stride Rite's corporate headquarters in Roxbury in 1971. It was, I mean, we see that now, but we certainly didn't back then. Was it that mixed sense of feelings about whether or not making money that was a calling that drove you to things like building daycare centers, investing in the community where your company was?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I thought it was also, I did it because it made sense to do it. Actually, I think it enhanced whatever success I had in business. And it actually did enhance the success of the company. But I didn't know that at the time. It just felt comfortable for me. Stride Rite became rather conspicuous in the country or in the business community because my peers thought that I wasn't focusing on our business. And yet the business did so well over time. It was considered to be the third most successful business in the country. I think that was like 85. To 92 when I stepped down.
It was intriguing to me that you seem to have a distrust or a dislike of large corporations and conglomerates. There's so much in the sort of the business management literature about how growth, constant growth, is so important. You know, what's the tension there? Why did you have a distrust of these bigger corporations and conglomerates? And is there a path for a corporation to continue to grow and not head down that path that you distrusted?
Well, I thought too many corporations were run for the benefit of the people at the top, people running companies not as successful as, say, Stride Rite, were drawing huge salaries. So it became, in some, not all cases, the companies were run for the benefit of the board and the management, as opposed to building something that included everyone that participated in the success of the company.
I wondered also why you resisted your employees at Bluebonnet unionizing. I know you had experience working with unions and their members. The AFL-CIO representative said they had pledge cards that showed the majority of your employees wanted to unionize. You wanted to hold off on an official vote. Do you remember why that was important to you?
No, it isn't true that I wanted to hold off. Instead of having pledge cards, I insisted on an election. And I made it very clear to the organizers that if our workers wanted a union, I'm happy to go along with the union. That was their decision, not my decision. But the only way I could make a determination was to have a free and open and supervised vote and have the National Labor Relations Board oversee the election just to make sure there wasn't any intimidation on the part of the workers or on my part.
I want to shift gears now. I know another passion of yours has been politics. You have spoken out against the role of money in our political system, worked hard on campaign finance reform, but you were also a serious donor and did a lot of fundraising for political candidates. How do you think about being somebody who's advocating for campaign finance and also really effective and powerful in raising money for individual candidates?
Well, I knew that no change would ever come about unless we had the right people in office. So I did spend money trying to promote and move people with interests that coincided with mine into positions of political power. Unfortunately, you can't succeed in the political world as it's constituted here in this country without funds, and I became a funder of people that I thought would make a difference and change the way we ran our government and we ran our country.
Did doing that fundraising feel distasteful for you, given how you feel about campaign finance?
Very much so. It was something I didn't like, but I also had to live in the real world. My choice would have been to not have done so, but then I couldn't have changed, or I couldn't have at least participated in trying to change the status quo. Too many good people choose not to get involved in politics because they can't stomach it.
With a true lifetime of experience under your belt now, what do you think is the number one imperative for American businesses right now?
I do think they have to become more far-sighted. And there are, I'm sure, many people that are who run companies. But I think too many companies are run for the benefit, as I said earlier, of the people at the top. And I don't feel that they're trying to build an institution that allows everyone to participate. The business schools, most of them that I'm aware of, somehow focus on developing graduates who want to make lots of money. And I don't think that they introduce other dimensions in the curriculum of business schools. I mean, I'm familiar with Harvard Business School, and I don't feel that the students learn that they have a public trust. And I think that's language that they're not interested in.
With all of that in mind, what do you hope has been your legacy?
I haven't thought about my having a legacy. I try to be a good citizen. I try to be a good businessman. And compared to many other people in the corporate world, I enjoyed some measure of success, both in terms of making a company successful, being able to demonstrate that you could pay your workforce higher wages and develop more productivity.
Let's focus on the greater Boston community, where you've invested so much and where you've come up. What would your most fervent wish for our community be today?
Well, then I think we would address poverty, which we allow to just fester without any involvement on the part of the city or the business community. I just think that we tend to look the other way. There are too many young people, kids dropping out of school. And just if we have a minimum wage, we should have a minimum standard of living. It isn't economic, if you have to look at it from a dollars and cents point of view, to allow the kind of poverty to exist. It's an expense for the taxpayers, and it isn't morally the right environment for our young generations to grow up in. We have to do some serious thinking about the status quo and how we can improve upon it.
That's Arnold Hyatt, longtime president and CEO of StrideRight. Thank you so much for your time today.
It was nice to talk with you.
If you're interested, you can read more about Arnold's life story in the new biography, Arnold Hyatt, Turning Business into a Force for Good, by Barry Wagner. More details can be found on our website, radioboston.org. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman. We have engineering today by Jimmy Kiesling and Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.